Okay then, folks, I think we'll make a start. Welcome to this Tyneside Stop the War Coalition public meeting on the topic of Afghanistan. It's sort of somehow the forgotten war, so it is important, I think, that we continue to have these meetings. My name's Tony Dowling. I'm a teacher in Gateshead, primary school teacher, and I'm a member of the Tyneside Stop the War Coalition Committee, and have been for about the last 10 years or during the course of this this war on terror. In actual fact, we're very quickly approaching the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan this year, I think it is. And war in Afghanistan and then in Iraq was meant to cement US power and influence around the world. And as we were told at the time, the new century was to be the American century, and Bush's neoconservative project was to promote American global leadership through a policy of military strength and moral clarity. I think we've seen that the peoples of Afghanistan and Iraq have paid a very high price and are still paying a very high price for this moral clarity. And in Britain, our government has slavishly supported the warmongers in Washington, fixing the intelligence around the policy. And after all of these years, senior military commanders and diplomats in Afghanistan now tell us that there can be no military victory there, and the best that can be hoped for is to fight the Taliban to a standstill and then negotiate. We also now have the potential expansion of NATO eastwards that has gone on through Bosnia, and now with the situation in the Middle East, there are again threats of no-fly zones in Libya, which would again, as we would expect, lead to occupation and invasion of foreign countries. So we need to continue to campaign against these things. Billions and billions of pounds, hundreds of billions of pounds and dollars have been spent and wasted on these wars, which have been part of the contribution to the financial problems that we're facing at the moment. And so these are reasons that we need to continue our campaigning both in and outside of the anti-war movement. This evening we've got two very, very excellent speakers with us. Very pleased that they're able to get here. We have Joan Humphreys from Military Families Against the War. Joan is the grandmother of the soldier Kevin Elliott, who was killed back in August 2009. And we also have with us Craig, I've forgotten you. Thank you very much, Craig Heinsohn, who's an ex-soldier who's written a book about his experiences since he's fought both in Kosovo and Afghanistan. That's right, isn't it?
I was in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So Craig lives locally as well, is that right, in Gateshead?
Yes,
local lad. So it'll be interesting to hear of his experiences. We're going to start with Joan. Joan's going to speak for about 20 minutes or so, and then probably the same from Craig. And then there'll be a little bit of time for us to have some questions and some discussion later on. Before I do, start, I do need to thank the university here and the Politics, Space, Power Research Cluster of Newcastle University's School of Geography, Politics and Sociology, who have helped us to organise this meeting and book the rooms here. So thank you to them. Joan, hand over to you.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you very much for allowing me to come and talk to you. Well, what I want to say basically is, for me, overall, the Afghan war seems to have dropped out of everyone's conscience recently. I mean, obviously not the ones gathered here tonight, but what's happening in Libya is, of course, dreadful, and what's happening in Bahrain with Saudi Arabia becoming involved is even worse. Saudi is a country I have a problem with. Saudi seems to be extremely active worldwide, and the UK and the USA ignore their unacceptable behaviour, but the carnage still continues. Now, we know that when Afghanistan was invaded, 7th of October 2001, we were told it was because they were responsible for 9/11, which was of course totally untrue. We were told that the people involved trained in Afghanistan, also untrue. They trained in several states in America and in Germany. Now, I am not suggesting we attack those nations, but if someone's got to be attacked, surely it should be the nations who trained them and who put the money up, which was Saudi. I mean, Osama bin Laden was a Saudi. Now, I'm not going to do a lecture against Saudi Arabia, but their behaviour in Bahrain this week has caused me to think more about them. And David Cameron really struggled yesterday in Parliament to say anything against Saudi. He just won't do it. I'd love to know why. I mean, we can all guess it's the oil and all that, but lots of other countries have oil as well, and he's quick enough to speak out against them. But for some reason, they won't speak out against Saudi. Now, the facts are that along with one Lebanese, one Egyptian, and three people from the United Arab Emirates, 15 of the people on the planes who committed those horrific attacks in America on the 11th of September 2001 were Saudi Arabians. Again, just unbelievable. Osama bin Laden, whom they seem to consider the devil incarnate, I'm not very keen on myself, but he's also Saudi. And I am not trying to make this a let's hate Saudi, but I do. But that's irrelevant. We also believe that they financed 9/11 as well, which is quite a difficult thing to say. But I just thought I'd get that over with first. But instead of attacking somewhere like Saudi, what Britain and America did, and along with the other 141 countries who attacked Afghanistan, who attacked people, was Afghanistan. Now, one of the poorest countries in the world. There are all reasons we may have discussed later why we might have attacked Afghanistan, but it doesn't make any sense to me. But we got told that Afghanistan was attacked because they were sheltering bin Laden. I should imagine by the time the 7th of October came up when they did attack Afghanistan, bin Laden was well gone. It was 3 weeks and 5 days after the bombing of the Twin Towers, the crashing of the Twin Towers, etc., that America attacked. Now, under the law, it says that there are all sorts of reasons about having a just war. One, you must have a just reason. Well, there was no just reason for attacking Afghanistan. Two, you have to ensure that civilians and non-combatants don't get killed. But I'm sorry, but as far as I know, there are somewhere in the region of 60,000 civilians have been killed in Afghanistan. There's been 60,000 innocent women, children and men killed there. There have been over 7,500 of the invasion forces, of which British soldiers were involved, and there have been 359 of them killed. And finally, over 30,000 Taliban and Al-Qaeda have died. Not that I feel much sorrow about their deaths, but nevertheless, they have lost their lives in a criminal war. Those figures are up to around 100,000 dead. Now, this would be a horrific total in any century, but in the 21st century, it's barbaric. This is the longest conflict the UK has been involved in since the Napoleonic Wars in the 19th century. There are all those people dead, as I say, about 100,000 when you add up dead, and so many more physically and mentally damaged, which is, and for what? Well, I don't know why, and I doubt if you do. We get given many suggestions from politicians as to why our troops are dying in a country that has not made any attacks on the Western world. As I said earlier, Afghanistan was originally blamed for the attacks which took place in the USA. They apparently allowed the perpetrators to train in Afghanistan. As I said earlier, no, that didn't happen. And nor were there any Afghanis involved on that day. Then we get told, well, that was one reason it was false for attacking Afghanistan. Then we're told the invasion is to keep the streets of the UK safe and protect the lives of British people. Well, the only attacks in this country took place after we had joined America and the other 141 countries which have invaded Afghanistan. There have been 143 countries involved in the invasion of Afghanistan. Now, people have said to me, no, not possible, but it is. You can find it on the internet. Look up NATO, you'll find the 143 countries. Some have now left, but at one point there was 143 different countries. Oh, some only had one or two people, but they were there. And by doing that, they were supporting America, Britain, and the so-called ISAF, the International Security and Assistance Force. Another word for NATO. But I keep wondering who they're making secure and who they're assisting. They're certainly not making the Afghanis secure, they're not making the British people secure, they're not making the servicemen secure. As far as I can see, the only assistance they're giving to anyone is to people like the Carlyle Group or BAE, all the arms manufacturers. They're securing what they can do. They are not doing anything to help the Afghanis in any way whatsoever. Um, And that really, it gets to me because they're not doing what they say. I mean, the security or the assistance, as far as I can see, is for, as I said, Carlyle Group B, which George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., and our ex-Prime Minister, John Major, he was actually, they're on the board, the Bushes. George Major was actually the president of that company. Now, he didn't object to the Afghan war until he stopped that job in 2005. But from 2001 until 2005, he was quite happy what was going on in Afghanistan. He was making the money. George Bush Sr. was making the money. George Bush Jr. was making the money. And there is so much finances involved in that. And it's not just a few pounds, it's hundreds of billions of pounds and dollars monthly. Not yearly, monthly they were making. I mean, John Major, who wasn't a particularly wealthy man, is now an exceptionally wealthy man. The Bushes have always been wealthy. But that's where all the money, you know, why we're there is to make those people richer, and that angers me beyond anything. Also, there was a chap in the last government, a guy called Phil Lewis, you've no doubt heard of him. He was an immigration minister, and he said, now this is exactly verbatim, but what he actually suggested was, our soldiers were dying in Central Asia to stop the immigration of Afghanis to this country. Now, I mean, there are a lot of sick reasons for attacking Afghanistan, but that to me is the worst. Fortunately, he's not a MP any longer. But the Afghanis wouldn't be coming to this country if they weren't trying to escape from what we've done to them. We have killed 100,000 of them. 60,000. It's 100,000 dead. Now, if you look at that amount, let's assume each person who's been killed had 10 close family members. That is now 1 million people bereaved. And I mean, it's unbelievable, because I know my life will never be the same after what happened to my grandson. I know the rest of the family's life will never be the same. I mean, a bit more than 10 of us, there's quite a lot. I mean, I've got 19, well, I had 19 grandchildren, I've got 18 now, so there's a lot of people in the family. And for that to happen, it's unbelievable. I mean, 1 million people bereaved. Now, I know there have been worse things, but I'm not very sure where or when, certainly not in the 21st. It should be happening in the 21st century. And then added to that is all those who have been maimed, both physically and mentally. They and their families are going to suffer for the rest of their lives. We're going to have the pain of losing Kevin, but at least one day we're going to get up, and I don't know when it'll happen, but because he's not sitting there, it's not going to hurt so much. If you get up and look at your child sitting there, minus limbs, minus eyes, mentally affected, all sorts of ways, that is never going to change. I mean, the army said initially they were going to let them all stay in the army. No, they're not. They're throwing them all out as fast as they can. The army, the navy and the air force. I mean, they're just getting rid of them at a great rate of knots. We know that's happening, including some who are serving in Afghanistan and got their email telling them they were fired. But they're actually out there serving. Now, and what we've been told too is one of the reasons given for the invasion was to protect the lives of British citizens. Well, obviously, those whose bodies have arrived back in the UK in coffins on transport planes don't enter the equation. Soon the 359th person killed will be repatriated, the Irish chap from the Irish Rangers. And as the military say, he'll be repatriated. I loathe that word. As I said, Kevin was on one of these transport aircraft in 2009 after his death in Helmand on the 31st August 2009, and I didn't want to think of him being repatriated. To me, he was coming home, not in the way I had wanted him, nor any of the other soldiers, airmen, to come back to their families. I regularly have people saying to me that Kevin was a soldier, and soldiers know what to expect when they enlist. Can't accept that, because at the age of 17, 18, they don't. I can't think of any young people who do not believe they are indestructible. Death is for old people, not healthy young men in their teens and 20s. Having been anti-war for all of my adult life, I do get asked how I felt when Kevin decided to enlist. Well, I was so angry that the only thing that he could find to do with his life, apart from being a drug addict or whatever, was to enlist. I was worried he would change, which he did. Not too much, but he definitely changed. He changed from the cheeky, loving boy I watched growing up. And of course, I was worried what would happen to him, and there was fear that he could be injured. I couldn't even consider that he could be killed. It was... Now that I don't think what's happened, I want to ensure no more families face what is called a knock on the door. It's not a knock on the door that ruins your life, it's opening it and seeing the guy standing there with the regimental tie. You know what they've come to tell you. I remember saying to the guy, tell me he's been injured. No, damn fine, he hadn't been injured, he'd been killed, or he wouldn't have been there, because they tell you on the phone if they're injured. I think you'll agree with that, Craig, that's what happens. So, I mean, you know what they've come to tell you. And now, each time it's announced a member of the British military has been killed, the pain you feel for the family is as bad as your own pain. You know what they're going to have to face for the next 8 to 10 months. They've got to go RAF line them. Well, they don't have to, but they've got to RAF line them. Watch the plane landing, carrying the body of a dearly lost husband, son, grandson, father, brother. Then you go and stand in Mouton Basset, seeing the hearses going past, which is, for me, was cathartic. Now, a lot of people have said it's creepy, horrific. I don't believe that. Most people find it very cathartic. The support you get in Mouton Basset from people who don't know you is amazing. It's just, it gives you the strength to go through what you've got coming up next. They then get taken to hospital in Oxford post-mortem, and a couple of weeks later you get them back. Then there's the funeral. In Kevin's case, it was a military affair, which was, for me, horrific. I've never had a great deal of time for the military. I do support the boys who are in Afghanistan and who are in Iraq, because they are doing a job that none of us would like to do. I don't know how many of you've done it. I don't know how many other people here have been in forces and fought. But majority of people don't want to do that. Would you like to do it?
No.
And that's the situation. But then you have the long wait until the inquest. In our case, it was June of last year. And the reason you have to go through all this is because politicians have lied to us, to everyone, to you, everyone in this room. None of the reasons given for our service personnel dying, being injured in a mortal war are valid. Honesty from our so-called leaders is what we want to have. To admit that Kevin and all those who have died so the USA can have bases close to Iran, so that when the inevitable attack on that country takes place, the infrastructures are there. Or perhaps they can admit the resources, minerals, etc. is what they want. But a few minutes ago I mentioned Kevin's inquest. I went down to it and various people spoke, and then a guy from the Special Investigation Branch of the military went in. And the coroner, whom I'd already written to, he wasn't very sure how I was going to react. And he said, if you found the people who killed Kevin, what would he be charged with? He'd be charged with murder. Now, it took all my self-control to stand up and say, no, the Afghanis are not responsible for my grandson's death. George Bush, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, they're responsible for Kevin's death. Nothing to do with the Afghanis. If someone attacked my country, I hope I would have the, because I'm not a pacifist, I hope I would have the ability to fight back. And that's what they're doing. And although I loathe the Taliban and everything they stand for, yeah, there's racism, there's sexism, there's fight, but it is their country. We shouldn't be there. As I said too, also a lot of the things are for profits, for the people who are already rich. I mean, all these cuts, take the troops to Afghanistan, none of those cuts have to happen. Those cuts are, they're lies. Again, it's like going to Afghanistan. Let's make life as hard as we can for the working classes. I mean, really, that's what it's about. Even the middle classes, because we're superior. I mean, yeah, the first 20 of the men in the front row of the government now are multimillionaires. I mean, how can they understand anything? Yeah. And I mean, there was quite a few. Tony Blair was not exactly skint either. Gordon Brown wasn't exactly wealthy. But when you look at the other ones, a lot of them were very wealthy and they were just getting more money. What I feel is it's so wrong that our service personnel and dying in even greater numbers. Kevin was the 210th to be killed since the invasion of Afghanistan. And that was after 94 months of war. Since then, in less than 19 months, more than 149 people have been killed, plus a dog, which people seem to be a lot of time talking about. Not so much about the guy from Kirkcaldy who was killed, but oh, the poor wee dog. Sorry, I love animals, but not to that extent. And we get told by the government and the military things are getting better. Simple sums. 94 months, 210. 19 months, 149. I mean, when you work that out, I mean, it's getting worse and worse daily. It's been quiet recently, apart from the two people who were killed, the guy from the veterinary corps and the guy from the Irish Rangers. But it's going to build up again, because it always quietens down a bit during February, March, then it builds up April, May, June, July, August. That's when the most killings have always taken place in Afghanistan. You get the figures on the internet if you can bother going through them all. But what I feel is we've got to be listened to, and the majority of people in the UK have to be listened to. Our troops need to come out of there now. Not in 5 weeks, 5 months, and certainly not in 15 months. The British Army, Navy and Air Force cannot and must not be in Afghanistan any longer. I think it's really important that you're at this meeting tonight and you want to fight against what's happening. Write to your MPs. Get in touch with your MPs. Say, why? Check and see if they turned up when the only debate against about Afghanistan was held in the House of Commons. I think it was the 9th of September. I was there. Nearly got thrown out by that little point. And ask them, if they weren't there, why weren't they? Why didn't they come and vote? There's over 600 members of Parliament. There were about 362 turned up. 18 against, the rest four. Now, your MP should tell you why he didn't turn up to vote. It doesn't matter how he was going to vote. The fact that 300 didn't bother. Now, when I spoke to an MP about this, he said, oh, well, once we're elected, we're not responsible to the electorate, which really surprised me somewhat. But in fact, that's actually the situation. Once they get elected, they are responsible only to the whips in their party. One or two, like, for example, Jeremy does it, John O'Donnell does it, Colonel Lucas has no whip anyhow. There's a Welsh guy, Jonathan Edwards, one or two others who step out with the party line, but most of them don't. But the majority of them are not likely to lose their jobs anyhow. They are MPs that are respected and admired. Carolyn Lucas, she's pushing it a bit because this is her first time in. She's the only Green in Parliament. But please write to your MPs. Ask them, if they didn't vote, why didn't they vote? If they did vote, why did they vote for the war? You'll find the names of all the names on the internet. Just look up the date of the Afghan debate. And if everybody writes, if you write, your family writes, your cousins, your aunties, everybody writes and asks their MP, why didn't you do it? We don't want our troops in Afghanistan. Would you please, please stand up for what your constituents want, not for what the three-line whip wants? Because that's what happens. They're whipped in it. I keep thinking about this when you're somebody going around right in the way back in the Roman times hitting somebody with a lash. But what I really want more than anything else is to get the troops brought home before the death toll in Afghanistan rises anymore. For the British, the American, the other 141 countries, particularly the Afghani people, their lives are ruined. There's millions of them in camps in Pakistan and various countries all around. They've had to flee from their own home. And that shouldn't happen. I mean, we saw it happening from Libya, people trying to get Egypt and all that. But we all know how disgusting Egypt is. Libya is, how Gaddafi is. Nobody seems to think that perhaps David Cameron, Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, George Bush, Barack Obama are equally disgusting, because they're technically elected democratically. When you consider America, 43% of the population voted the last election, and it's not much more in this country. So we've got to persuade people to vote, the people who care, and we've got to get them people to bring our troops home now before anybody else has to go to Lynham and Boot and Bassett. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for that, Joan. It's always interesting to have people like yourself come along and speak, because although we've been talking about these issues for 10 years, there are still new bits of information and things that we haven't heard that enliven the debate and lead us on. I think the interesting thing at the moment is that, as you pointed to the numbers of deaths, I mean, obviously the number of troops killed is still rising, but also the United Nations says that the number of civilians killed in recent times is higher than it's ever been. So whilst the war is slipping off some of the news stands, it's still having a devastating effect, and we need to still campaign to make sure that we find a way to stop that happening. And as Jones says, one of the things we can do is to write to our MPs, and even if we've done it before, I think it's still worth continuing to do that. Okay, thank you, Jones. I'm going to have a seat on a slight comfortable seat. I'd like to introduce now Craig. Craig Ryanson. Yes, I've got that one now. Sorry, I've got my bit of paper in front of me this time.
If you want to take a photo for the web, it's your job, wasn't it?
Yeah. Craig is going to talk a little bit about his time in the Army, but as much as anything else, about his time since being in the Army. Craig is the author of this little booklet, 12 Steps Back from the Abyss, which I won't bore you with trying to tell you what it's about. I'll let Craig do that. But as I say, Craig's a local lad from Lowfell in Gateshead, and he's fought in, tell us again, Kosovo and Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah,
so we'll hear a bit of the story from the other side, the other point of view now. Craig.
Thanks. So how many of you would like to make a positive change in the world? Thank you. Who wouldn't like to make a positive change in the world? Thanks for being honest. Okay, right. Thank you for allowing me to speak. So in 20 minutes, first of all, I'd like to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and spend an hour and a half here. And I'm going to commit to give you as much value as I possibly can in the next 20 minutes, half an hour, however long it kind of spins on for. I'd also like to thank Tony and Ricky for inviting me. I know they put a lot of work into this behind the scenes for very little time, so thanks very much for that. And of course, thank you for Joan for speaking and for all the effort that you've put in over the last years. So I'd like to give Joan a round of applause. Dundee. Okay, when Ricky called me, he said, look, we've got this stop the war thing, can you come along? And I said, well, I would, except I'm a big believer in what you focus on in life expands. And I'm not Mother Teresa by any stretch of the imagination, but Mother Teresa said she would never take part in an anti-war rally. She would, however, take part in a pro-peace rally. So I'm here for the peace. It's not quite as compelling because we're not quite so scared of peace as we are as war. But that's what I've kind of been doing and working on myself for the last 4 or 5 years. And someone touched, I don't know if it was Stephen or Ricky, but a quote made by Gandhi, which is, be the change in the world that you want to see. Which has taken me 40 years to work that one out, but I think I'm getting a little closer than I've been for a long time. Is it right to tell you a little bit about my story? I don't want to bore you or just sound as though I'm going on about myself. But basically, I'm a veteran from Kosovo, Afghanistan and Iraq. Well, the Iraq war, really. Kosovo, I was in the Navy for 15 years. I was an engineering officer. A ship I was on, HMS Cumberland, was patrolling the Adriatic. We were the Adriatic guard ship during the kind of Kosovo thing, and we were stopping ships and checking them out for weapons and all that sort of stuff. So all I say, Kosovo, I wasn't actually in there on the ground and amongst all the troops. And then I got attached to the Marines. Kind of a little bit against my will, but I got attached to the Marines basically to stay in Plymouth, and then 2 weeks later I was in Afghanistan. Now, as an engineering officer, I sit in the back of the ship with the lads drinking tea and making sure the gas turbines are turning and powering the ship through. But very quickly, I was all with my helmet and all the body armour and grenades, and I would wander through the middle of a Bagram Air Base. I don't know if anyone remembers Bagram Air Base from like the Russians when they were there. There was a huge, they planted 10,000 landmines around the Bagram Air Base. And then when the Mujahideen, who, from what I understand, are led to believe they were backed by the US, when the Mujahideen came down from the mountains, basically sent the kids through the minefields, took over, like beat the Russians, they then planted 10,000 mines. Unlike the Russians, they just put them anywhere. And then when the Mujahideen finally kind of transposed into the Taliban or went back to wherever they were from, the warlords, the local warlords, then planted 10,000 mines. So we're in this small strip of land that was surrounded by 30,000 mines. The SBS, the Special Forces, had been in just beforehand doing most of the action, most of the killing they needed to do, and I was left with the raw Marines, and it was like a scene from Vietnam. It was all bunkers and just machine guns pointing out, and we were all in a little compound, and gradually they started clearing the mines, and all around us were like hundreds and hundreds of wrecked Russian aircraft, major transport planes that had been left there from 10 years previously. And I don't know about you, but I mean, whilst our troops are phenomenal, you know, the Russians have got a lot less to lose. You know, the Russians just, they're tough and vicious. So I was thinking, well, this is not a good sign. Now, before I went, I'd actually did a bit of reading on the first and second Afghan wars. Is anyone kind of aware of that, or just any passing interest in that? Yeah. Well, the first Afghan war, which was something like 1838, when the empire was a major power and could steamroller just about anything, we pulled out after 3 years, losing 12,000 troops in the withdrawal over a period of about a month. And then in the second Afghan war, similar thing, there was a major battle and basically the troops got overrun. What happened is the Afghans that were fighting for us, when we stopped paying them, they went round to the other side, and then suddenly there was twice as many Afghans facing the military. There was a battle called the Battle of Maiwan, which, strangely enough, when I was in Afghanistan, I brought back a British musket that was lost back then. I was going to bring it in, but I wasn't sure, you know, how much equipment I'd have and whether it would be relevant or not. So anyway, so that was the time in Afghanistan. And we, to be honest, the Marines came back, and we came back pretty intact. Well, in fact, completely intact. You know, a few people around us have been blown up, but not ourselves. And then the 2003 Iraq war went, and we were floating off in the ocean for months and months and months, it seemed like. I was attached because I was the Navy guy, so I was put with one of the companies of commandos that got dropped into the Al-Faur Peninsula from the sea. Most people went over from Kuwait because there were so many Americans all stacked up there. They basically wanted Kuwait to move through, so the UK sent some commandos by sea. I think it was just the Navy wanted to have their little thing as well. So anyway, so we spent a couple of months there, and then obviously when the day the war started, you know, there were just loads of Scud missiles going over the top. You could just hear them going over. Not Scud missiles, sorry, the Patriot missiles, the ones that the US were firing. That's a great name, isn't it? Patriot Freedom missiles. Man, it's a missile. It's going to kill thousands of people. But anyway. So anyway, they sent those missiles over, and then from the warship HMS Ark Royal I was on, we had the big Chinook helicopters, and they filled the Marines with it, and they had these trucks called Pinsgowers, which are just like little, they're almost like, they look kind of the same size as a VW Beetle, but they're green, and they're not a VW Beetle, a camper van, you know, the VW camper vans, but they're green, and obviously they're bombed up. There's lots of guns and bombers on them and stuff. So basically the Chinooks went over, dropped them on, and they landed in on the Al-Faur Peninsula under fire. And that was D Company, and then the other guys went crossing the line. Some of the unit that I was, the very first day they lost a helicopter full of troops, flew into one of the sergeant majors of basically what's called Brigade Patrol Troop, which was like, they're like SBS, but they were attached to the Marines. One of the sergeant majors, a friend of mine, had said, oh, you know, apparently he'd been in touch with his wife saying, these American pilots, they're a nightmare. I'm really scared about this. And sure enough, his helicopter, they hit overhead wires. So obviously he had some sort of premonition going on there. And that was 8 dead right there. And so the lads went in, relatively few casualties, to be honest. And then I went across, I dropped into Kuwait, and I invaded a sovereign country bearing arms. I've never done that before. And it was the most surreal experience of my life. It really was. It was kind of like being on training, but everything, all the roads were empty apart from blown up things and tanks, American tanks, shooting and stuff. So we ended up just south of Basra, before Basra was taken. and there was a big tank battle a week or so later. So that's kind of what went on in Afghanistan. Well, I ended up in Azerbaijan port, and then for me, one of the surrealist. Is this okay for everyone? I'm not just going on too much. Mm-hmm. I just hate to think. I went into Azerbaijan port, which is a big port complex, which had been cleared out, and I was actually part of the HQ, so I was a bit of a shiny ass. I wasn't really out at the front shooting people because I was a liability. I was in the Navy, but there was a day when one of these. They had a bridge further up the river. It was a mobile, it was a tank with a bridge on, and they'd drop it over, and then the troops would go across, do their thing, and come back. And then the CO's got everyone together and said, look, Chemical Ali has said that if you don't take an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, go out there and start shooting at those guys, I'm going to kill your family. And that's what we were told. That day, the amphibious boat squadron, the CO took it on himself to take his squadron up the river. Little did he know that there was commando brigades either side of the river, and they'd been told that there was no one on the river, so they thought it was these Iraqi special forces coming up the river. So they started shooting at them, and then 539 thought, Iraqi special forces are shooting at us at the bridge, and they started firing. I didn't realise this at the time. What happened with me was, I was in a compound and this big tank pulled up with the bridge on the front, and they said, man, look at all these bullet holes here. And I was like, wow. He said, yeah, we were just crossing a bridge and some Iraqis in boats started shooting us. And then one of the Marines pulled out his, it's an anti-tank weapon. He said, pulled out his, not Milan, but it was an anti-tank weapon. And he said, man, you should have seen him. He took it straight out like that. That night in our hospital was full of blown up Marines, and they were trying to put them back together. Strangely enough, even still, this is the most surreal day of my life to date. It might get stranger, but there was the guy that I worked for was a Marine captain, and he turned around the day before. He's going, man, do you realise we're making history? Because he's a gung-ho. These Marines are gung-ho. They're great people to have on your side. We're making history. We're here. We're actually making history. And I was like, great. That night, I heard the scream in our room. I ran in to see what was going on. He collapsed on the floor. Just died like that. So I was giving him mouth to mouth for 30 minutes while the regimental sergeant major legged up the road to the hospital, which was full of Marines getting patched up so no one could get here. And they came back kind of 30 minutes later and said, look, he's gone. I was like, well, okay, fair enough. I always thought I had quite an open mind as far as when people's time comes. So we kind of finished that piece, and then... And then about a week, well, it took weeks and weeks it was about 2 weeks till the war fighting finished. And this chap, his name was Steve, his body went back to Kuwait. I knew him quite well, and I knew his wife. His wife was the same age as my wife, and she was actually pregnant, which is making me think, why the hell are you out here? Because he'd actually had a big leg injury, and I believe that's probably linked to why he died. So he went back, his body was taken down to Kuwait. And a couple of weeks later, they wanted someone to take the bodies out to the first transporter plane. Now, this for me was one of the most bizarre things. I don't know if you remember, but it was almost like a game show. They were watching how many miles up towards Baghdad the Americans could get. Do you remember that? It was like Sky News was going, oh, yeah, and there's 150 miles left to go. And they were just racing up this road. At the same time, we had Sky TV in this HQ. So... we were kind of watching what was going on. And I went down into Kuwait to put Steve's body on the plane with Marines, because you have the coffin, you carry it on, it looks nice and smart and tidy. So we put one on, and then there was another five coffins left of the guys from the ship, the helicopter pilots, which I also knew to put on. So I said to the Marines, I said, look, they're Navy, we're Navy, can you give me a hand, can we get these on? So we ended up marching about, I think it was six coffins on in the end. But this was the transporter plane, the very first transporter plane that came back. I don't know if you remember it. There was a big to-do. The Prime Minister was there. And there was 11 coffins all covered in flags. Now, I'll tell you, those 11 coffins, about 10 of them were blue on blue. So 10 of them weren't killed by the enemy. But, you know, that's a sad thing. But the fact is, when you're in war, they take a lot of safety catches off of stuff that you do. A waste, but just a part of really... what that commitment is. Okay, so I came back from I came back from Iraq and we got flown out and it's instantaneous. Sorry, that was the point I was going to make. I went back to the warehouse, we drove back into Iraq that night, and I watched the aeroplane land in Bryce Norton, and I was watching the whole procedure of like these bodies being taken off. So although I wasn't kind of in amongst it, you're constantly, well, technology makes it possible for you to be constantly bombarded by what's going on all the time. I wouldn't say it was distressing, but I kind of remember stopping and thinking, man, I seem to have a low ongoing level of stress here for some bizarre reason, because I was in quite a benign place. So the technology nowadays is like a double-edged sword, I'd suggest. You know, there's a place for it, and a time and a place for it, but just kind of generally broadcasting it to people perhaps isn't the thing. Anyway, so the war fighting finished, and because of I'd understood in the previous, that was the Gulf then, the Gulf of Iraq, the previous, getting a bit confused there, in Afghanistan, I was like, right, let's get out of here as quickly as possible, because while we were there, the Americans were paying off a lot of the warlords, and you could see the CIA were going around all the time, and I thought, as soon as they stopped paying them, I remember what's happened in the past, you know, they're going to start shooting at us, so let's get out of here as quickly as possible. And then, and similarly, in Iraq, the Marines are sent in more or less as shock troops. They go in first, like the paratroopers, the elite forces go in first to mess things up. Not to mess things up, to get a job done quite quickly. So as soon as we finished the kind of commando stage of it, we were flown out. So again, instantaneously, we're back home. This time, a little bit different to Afghanistan, not everyone came back. And of course, this was probably the first time, you know, that... the Marines had lost people like that for a while, although they do quite regularly lose people. So for me, I was fine. Now, for the first time in my life, I felt a little bit flat when I came back. Anyone felt a bit flat here before? Anyone felt, yeah, it's a natural way of being. For me, it kind of swung to one extreme and ended up... Well, it didn't happen soon. And I'll be honest, I always thought that people with mental health problems were making it up. All right? So I kind of came back home. 3 months later, I completely lost the plot. I was doing all right. And then I had to go and basically, the wife of the guy that died, I was giving mathematics, she wanted me to tell her what had gone on because the Marines hadn't told her. And the autopsy, which your experience takes months and months, and it's the most traumatic thing, eh? And even at the end, they didn't know because I guess it takes so long to get to bring his body home. Anyway, she wanted to know kind of what was going on, and I kind of took up a counselling role there, which probably didn't serve me. But there was a lot of other things going on, and obviously the way I was processing it perhaps wasn't as healthy as it could be. So, cut a long story short, I had a breakdown. I ended up going down the normal route of medication, and I don't know if anyone's experienced this, but actually it got worse under the medication, or if they've ever experienced. When you take medicine to treat a symptom, it doesn't always have the response that you're told it's going to have. So it got worse for me. And frankly, and this, I'm cutting this really short. This all kind of happened over 3 or 4 years. Under medication, if I'd had a switch out of an off switch, I'd have flicked it. You know, fortunately for me, that didn't happen. What happened was a number of things happened, but just to simplify, I met a chiropractor. He was 80 years old, and his eyes were on fire, and I was like, man, I want some of what he's got. And I'd organised a seminar. He was speaking to a bunch of chiropractors. And I don't know about you, I always thought chiropractic was about bad necks and bad backs. Is that kind of what you understood? Is that right? Yeah? Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. Well, he explained that actually the original chiropractor was working to restore nerve system function. Fact. Get my toy out here. I've only got a little bit of a board so I can kind of show it a little bit more iconically. Any idea what this might be? What is it? Spine. Well, actually, it's the nerve system. That's what we're focused on in the chiropractic office. But you're right. Most people focus on the bones and think that we're kind of bone doctors. What we're actually focusing on doing is we work with the spine. My wife's the chiropractor. She works with the spine to bring balance back to the spine to allow the signals going from the brain into the body to take pressure off these nerves, allows the signals to flow more effectively, which is kind of a simple idea, but it has pretty profound effects. I'll tell you about those in a second. So basically he explained that improve the spinal function, and he actually explained a few other principles as well. Basically, there's four pillars to health. Most people in society, if this is the symptom, we're taught to focus on a symptom and treat that symptom, make that symptom go away, if it's pain or vomiting or headaches or whatever. Whereas in chiropractic, what we're trying to do is raise the health level. As the health level raises, the body can better sort out the symptom. Because in our office, we actually say pain's a good thing. Now, not like the same reason the Marines say pain's a good thing, but why would we say pain's a good thing? Yeah, it gives you an indication there's something wrong, huh? It's a little bit like you've got a red oil light coming on the dashboard, tell there's no oil in the car. You don't get out the black masking tape, put it over the red oil light, carry on driving. That's that problem sorted out. You know, we don't think twice about doing it. We wouldn't do that to our car, but we don't think twice about doing it to ourselves. You know, so much advertising tape, added triple strength to get rid of the headache. Fight the fire with Gaviscon liquid. Doesn't say stop eating all that turkey for Christmas, does it? So in society, basically, we're taught to make that go away. In our office, we're going to raise the health level. Now, coming back to bringing peace to the world, war is the ultimate outside in. If this is the problem and you're sending in the troops, Gandhi's kind of thing was, well, look, let's just raise the health of the nation around it. Has anyone here read that story, Three Cups of Tea? There's a phenomenal book. There's a guy, his name's Mortensen. He went into Pakistan, he was a mountain climber, and he almost died on the mountain. I think he had a couple of friends that were killed. And this Pakistani village took care of him. And he recovered himself, and he said, when I recover, because he was a rich American, said, when I'm going to come back, and I'm going to build a school here. 55 schools he's built now in Pakistan for girls. Because you were saying earlier, Joan, about how they mistreat the women. Well, he saw that straight away. 55 girls' schools he's built with no government aid. Because he says, I can't take the American government, you know, the FBI are trying to get in there. He said, no, I can't take that. So really, the piece here is the power that one person can make. Earlier, we were put our hands up. We want to make a difference. You can make that difference. Okay. For me, it started here, making the difference here. So I'd met this chiropractor. I started taking regular chiropractic care. I started exercising, started eating good nutrition, started looking at my mental attitude, whether I was watching TV, whether I was meditating, or whether I was reading good books or just crappy books. And, you know, there's a time and a place for everything. You know, like war, there's a time and a place for everything. You know, I couldn't have meditated if Adolf Hitler was, you know, trying to cross the channel in 1941. That wouldn't have done a lot of good. But, you know, that's extreme emergency life-saving intervention. In the same way as, you know, if you go for surgery, hopefully you tried everything natural before that. And if you need to go for that surgery, then by all means, if you try everything else, exhausted, or go for it. But what we'd suggest in our office, kind of health-wise, is let's get you balanced first, make sure everything's working properly. So bring in the troops home. I'm all for that. You know, I don't think they're doing a lot out there. I don't have that magic word, the intelligence. You know, I don't mean how clever I am. I mean, you know, the military world or the politicians say, well, there's intelligence that this is happening, that's happening, and the other's happening. So I'm not sure whether war in Afghanistan is a good thing or not. I know, you know, peace is my thing, and, you know, anything that's against that, I'm not a fan of at all. So I think it's worth, well, I don't think, I know, it would be, if they were inspired within, if we were dealing with those issues in Afghanistan internally, we were building schools, like, I think his name's Eric Mortensen's doing. Now, he's done that himself. Now, what I've done is, excuse me, I'm talking about myself a little bit here. Right, so, just rewinding slightly, I started to recover my health, and I realised I could do it, and I was out running by the Armstrong Bridge, over there. Anyone know the Armstrong Bridge? Goes over Jesmond Dean. It's like the old antiques bridge. And it was cordoned off. Someone had jumped off it. The police were there. And they said, look, sorry if someone's jumped off. And I was gutted, because I thought perhaps if this person had had the principles or the understanding that I've now got, perhaps they wouldn't have done that. Who knows? But I said to myself, if I really pull myself around, get myself out of trouble, then I'm going to dedicate my life to spreading these ideas around. That was 6 years ago. And for the last 5 years, I own a chiropractic office with my wife, and I've been working in there. I run a workshop. It's the first thing we do, explaining these principles. Because the fact is, if someone doesn't even walk through the door and pay us a penny and take up care, but I've managed to do the workshop for them, then I know I've had the possibility to change something in their life, which is huge. It's huge for me, and it's part of my healing as well. I'll be quite honest, and I'd like to thank you because you allow me to speak here. It's part of my healing as well. So we've worked with GPs, nurses, solicitors. In fact, nurses are great to work with because they're really open-minded. And they're like, yeah, this makes sense. Solicitors, accountants, you know, the whole spectrum of life, of society. And we work to raise their health and quality of life, as I mentioned, by restoring nervous system function. And it brings people more life. And that's what I'm for, because I believe peace is expressing more life. So that's the first thing I did. The second thing I did, as Tony kindly mentioned, seeded for me, is I wrote a little booklet. It's called 12 Steps Back from the Abyss, a war veteran's journey from depression to joy. And I've been super, super over the moon with this, because inside the front page, it's like a little box for businesses and chiropractors and individuals to just write little notes to their friends. You know, saw this, was thinking of you. Now this really, it's a story about a guy that kind of overcome adversity, which I kind of like. But also, it's a little guide on raising your health. But you can do it subtly. Because if someone gives you a book here, this is about improving your health. You go, no, my health's all right. I don't need that. But there's 12 steps, and really those 12 steps are all to do with improving that health level. And so I've been over the moon. That business, I've actually had businesses buying 100 at a time. So like 100 copies is £150 each, and 10 copies are £2 each. And if you just want one copy, I'll let you guys buy a copy. I don't let the businessman buy one copy, or the chiropractors. I won't let them buy chiropractors buy less than 100, because they've got a lot of people that they can really touch. So that was that. And then, more importantly, I started this. This started 18 months ago with my wife. I said to her, look, I was in the military. I was married to a chiropractor. You know, I didn't understand this kind of nerve system thing as well as I should do. I had this breakdown, and I didn't really use chiropractic, the full benefits. So the lads coming out of the military or coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, because you can't admit weakness in the military. Yeah, that's not part of the MO. But what chiropractic really is to do with improving performance. So I've been into a couple of military bases talking about improving performance. And lads that have been to Afghanistan, Iraq, always come up to me afterwards and they say, well, look, sorry, not always, they have so far come up to me and said, look, this stress stuff that you went through, I'm going through it. You know, what can I do to improve my lot at the moment? So that's been hugely touching, again, part of my healing. It started off as our one office 18 months ago. I rang the Royal British Legion and said, look, I must admit, we've had this going for 18 months. No one's come in. I've been a bit divisive. I was using it to get on radio and stuff and get some publicity for the office. I'll be putting my hand up because I've been doing some training about that. And I said, but I've actually got no veterans in yet. And they said, look, it's a shame it's not national. So I rang my wife's chiropractic association and they said, we love that idea. It's great. And there are now 83 offices across the UK. Well, in fact, there's 55 across the UK, and there's another 20 across Europe and the States and Canada, providing about £2.2 million worth of care for veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq. That's retired or serving. So if you've got any friends, or you know anyone, or you know someone that might know someone, got this brochure, or even if you just write down the website, it's handsforheroes.org. The other thing you've got there, I don't know if you might need to use it for your publicity, but there's a direct link to the BBC site that's got all the lists. If you go to the website, it's called In Memoriam, and it's basically a link to the website that tells you the latest deaths. I know it's not a happy smiley thing, but sometimes when you need that information, if you can't find it, it's just one click. And it's good, you know, to try and keep things current. You're saying about things not being current. You can get that information almost instantaneously. That was the last piece I've done, really. Yeah, and I was so chuffed. This book's managed to get on the shelves in Waterstones in the Metro Centre, and I had an email about 6 weeks ago from a guy called Bob McKenna, and he was in Northern Ireland in 1975. He got blown up, and then he went back in to take two children out of a cafe before a secondary explosion went off. And he's brain damaged. He's been suffering from PTSD PTSD for 35 years. Now, rewind slightly, you go to the In Memoriam site, you'll see that there's 554 people. It's 179 plus 359, as you've said before. I'm not going to do that math. So it's 550 people who've died in Iraq and Afghanistan over the, well, since we've been there, 2001. Now, that's tragic, hugely tragic, and there's a lot of people suffering because of that. What's even worse and probably more dangerous is the fact that in the next 20 years or the next 14 years, combat stress says it takes 14 years for a lot of people's issues to come to the surface. You know, for me, it took 3 months. I was quite a quick one. And the figures they said from the first Gulf War, 25 people died. But within 19 years, 167 people had ended their lives, or their death was subject to an open inquest, an open verdict. So the point is, in other words, over seven times more people potentially are going to end their lives in the 20 years, the two decades following what's happening now. Which is why this has got a 20-year mission. And our aim is by the 11th of the 11th of the 11th to have 125 chiropractic offices in the UK. At the moment we're at 55. And to have... the aim is to have 9,000 veterans under care every year for the next 20 years. So that's kind of what I'm doing. The chiropractors love this. They're volunteering in spades. What I don't have is the military coming, which is ironic because there's a chiropractor next to some major bases. So I'm trying to train the... In fact, I'm not trying. I am training the chiropractors to do press releases and to go out into the community. If anyone knows how politically this can be kind of raised, you might well know, John. You seem to have a lot of experience there, taking it to the House of Commons. Just basically so the politicians will turn around. I've got military links to get the Chief of Defence Staff, that's my aim, to get him involved in this. But politically, if politicians can say, well, look, this is available, our troops can use it, then that's a good way to get the troops. And my focus at the moment is to get the chiropractors on board. Okay, does anyone have any questions? Thank you very much for your attention. Anyone have any questions?
Can I, Craig, thanks ever so much for that. It's been absolutely wonderful insight, both to your time in the wars and yeah, since then. Thanks. Can I suggest what I'd like to arrange things is, because Joan has to go to collect her train, and I'm going to take whiz her off shortly and get her back to the station, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions for yourselves. If we can maybe take questions or anything that Joan might be able to deal with first, and then I can take Joan off and I can leave people to you.